Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley speaking to you here from Washington, D.C., and the time has flown, and this is now our Christmas program. We're recording here on Friday the 19th of December, and this will be the Christmas show. We'll have another one next Saturday between the years, but this is the Christmas program. We'll try to do justice to that. So first of all, however, one of the main things you've got to do, right? Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, house the homeless, visit the sick, visit prisoners. And prisoner is now our friend Reverend Edward Pinckney. The trial was a monstrosity, and we've documented the collusion among corrupt witnesses, people who essentially lied during the voir dire, the screening of the jury, said that they weren't all one clique, and it turns out they were. It was a clique, and it involved the sheriff and the county commissioner. And now we've had the sentencing this past Monday, the 15th of December. Pinckney was sentenced to 30 to 120 months in prison. That is to say, from about 2.5 years to approximately 10 years. It's a monstrosity. He was not allowed to remain free on appeal. He was immediately handcuffed and taken to a state prison facility, Jackson, Michigan. And it was then held incommunicado in solitary confinement for a couple of days. Now, we're not even sure that he's out of that. We are trying to get Pinckney on this program today, but in order to do that, we've got to essentially go through the warden and the prison bureaucracy. So we're not sure. We started that some time ago now, some minutes ago, but we're not sure whether that's going to work. We will, in any case, devote a significant part of the second hour to the Pinckney case and what people need to do about that. And that involves, at this point, above all, publicity and fundraising to help to mount an appeal. And I'm especially reaching out to international journalists, people who are shocked by what's going on in the United States and would like to get to a case which is absolutely straightforward in what it represents. So as one commentator, I think Pinckney himself or somebody close to him said, this idea is 30 months, that's good behavior, that means you shut up. 120 months, 10 years in prison, that's if you don't shut up. So it's outrageous. Now, I want to say everyone who participated in the Pinckney mobilization should be absolutely proud of what was accomplished. The impact was significant. We were told that the prosecutor had actually aimed at a 25-year sentence. That was the life sentence that we talked about originally. But Prosecutor Sepik, or Septic, as we call him, has fallen short. And we can continue that process. Remember that Pinckney is the leading public opponent in large parts of Michigan, from all the way over in the west in Benton Harbor, all the way into Detroit and beyond. He's the big public enemy number one of this Michigan neo-fascist regime set up by the banks with Snyder, the governor, Upton, the congressman out there in the southwest corner, or the emergency manager who has just finished looting Detroit, Whirlpool Corporation, very big out there in western Michigan. So go back to the OSCE, go back to the foreign ministries, go back to the Organization of American States. Tell them the U.S. ambassadors have got to be called in, and now you demand explanations. Because before, we were warning of terrible events to come. Now, the sentencing, this monstrous frame-up has taken another big step forward. And, of course, it's important to make Judge Schrock, Prosecutor Sepik, Sheriff Bailey, County Commissioner Tyler, They should all know that the world is watching them. The whole world is watching, we said, at the corner of Michigan Balbo in August of 1968. And that's got to be the case for this, clique. Now, the line coming from the, what can we say, the repressive reactionary forces is that anyway, that Pinckney is a repeat offender, he's an incorrigible, criminal. And what do we find here? This is from, the local TV, WSBT TV, there in Berrien or Barbarian, County, Michigan. Pinckney's lengthy criminal past had an impact on his sentencing. His first run-in with the law was 1988 for assault with a dangerous weapon out of California, followed in 1990 by a theft conviction out of St. Louis, Missouri. 1999, Berrien County convicted of embezzlement. 2007, 4 felony counts for violating election law, and now 5 felonies for election forgery. 12 forgeries, 9 of them connected to voting. Well, let's put that in perspective. Those are counts, and those, the Berrien County ones, the 9 of them are frame-up counts. Now I've also got to bring in on this, one of the accusers now of Pinckney is one of the most odious characters here in Washington. And I'm talking about Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. And I'm going to tell you about Spakovsky in just a minute, right? Because this, if you're being accused by this guy, this is truly a badge of honor. You've seen him. He's been on C-SPAN. He's been on various reactionary, you know, Fox News type programs. But Spakovsky is the great anti-voter fraud exponent, right? He's the leading xenophobe, right? Von Spakovsky, his parents came here in the 50s as displaced persons, DPs, from the war in Europe, but now he's interested in keeping others out, this very, deplorable reflex that certain immigrant groups show, right? You get in and then you pull up the ladder. Well, sorry. So anyway, here we have the indictment of Pinckney at the hands of von Spakovsky and Jason W. Sneed, S-N-E-A-D. We'll find out about him for next week's program. But the famous one is von Spakovsky. So the idea is that there's a wave of voter fraud, the typical Republican argument, and Pinckney is the leading edge of the wave of voter fraud. And this you can find in a publication called The Daily Signal. And as I say, von Spakovsky is a top senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, Edwin Meese III, Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and he's the manager of the Heritage Foundation Election Law Reform Initiative. So the Pinckney case has gotten high-level attention from a top reactionary. A top reactionary torpedo is out there attacking Pinckney. Now, let me just refer to some of this stuff. Remember, under real Michigan law, these so-called forgery counts are misdemeanors. That's one of the appeals for appeal. There's also the question of Pinckney is accused of buying votes at $5 each at a soup kitchen. Oh, my God. The Republic is in danger. We'll be back in a minute on this one, on World Crisis. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. It's the 19th of December as we're putting on our Christmas show here. We will be somewhat more Christmassy here, but we're at the heart of the Christmas message here, as I tried to argue before. Now, von Spakovsky, and whether this guy is from nearer Pomerania or farther Pomerania, I do not know. The von looks like an East Elbian Junker. I'll be looking into that. it's not exactly the best democratic tradition. Remember, there were three classes of voters in Prussia, right? Three different levels. The poor, the middle, and then the super rich. Not such a good background. Anyway, Spakovsky is telling us that he's indignant because he expected the local community to come out and demand the lynching of Pinckney, that it wasn't enough to be lynched once by the court. It's now necessary to have him lynched again. So he puts him in the same class with Al Sharpton. Well, this is, I think, a higher and clearer example than anything Al Sharpton is up to. So he's indignant that the kangaroo court is being protested by the people there, and the idea is that buying votes, the accusation from Spakovsky, buying votes at $5 each at a soup kitchen. Now, but von Spakovsky gets his back up about this. All right. I'd like to go back to the case of Ed Rollins, Republican operative. Ed Rollins. This is somebody who was a top Reagan organizer. He was national director of one of Reagan's election campaigns. He worked for Huckabee in 2008. He worked for Bachman for a while. This is Ed Rollins. He's the one who got Foley out, right? He worked for Nethercutt back in 1994. His autobiography is Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. And the interesting one was in 1992-93, there was a gubernatorial election in New Jersey, and Ed Rollins admitted that he gave $500,000 of walking around money to various black ministers and black churches so they would not come out and vote for the Democrat Florio, and instead they would let the liberal Republican Christine Todd Whitman take the election. Now, why don't you put that in your pipe and smoke it there, von Spakovsky? $500,000 from a Republican thug to suppress the vote. I guess that's a different category, right? You can pay people to vote, not to vote, but not to vote. If you give somebody $5, aren't you really giving them their car fare to get to the polls? Don't all kinds of political machines provide rides to the polls? And if I don't have a car, maybe the only way is a bus, and $5 is what you need, and then you get a sandwich on the way back because you're out in the cold when you wouldn't be. Couple of things about von Spakovsky. So Heritage Foundation. Heritage Foundation means our friend Dement from the Cradle of Secession there in South Carolina. Von Spakovsky was a Bush appointee, a Bush recess appointee to the Department of Justice and the part of it that deals with voter fraud. That was January 2006. He was so partisan, he was a partisan Republican, so extreme, that he could not get confirmed in what was still a Republican-dominated Senate. Von Spakovsky is linked to the Federalist Society. That's the nest for the Rats Cabal, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, all from there. Von Spakovsky is the father of the modern voter ID, voter suppression strategy. That's him. In Georgia, he put in, after writing theoretical articles about how you gotta prevent voter fraud, he, put in a law in Georgia, and a judge then, struck it down. It was struck down by a federal judge saying, this is, like a Jim Crow era poll tax. And there it is. That's exactly what these, voter ID laws are all about. While von Spakovsky was in the, division of the DOJ that, does this stuff, one half of the career officials quit. And the best von Spakovsky could do after that was to be the vice chairman of the Fairfax Board of Elections in 2012. I don't know what, getting ready for Barbara Comstock or something like that. So how about that? The father of the modern voter ID, voter suppression strategy, who's at all of these reactionary forums. Look him up on C-SPAN. He's all over the place. That's who's attacking Pinckney. Okay, well, I think you get the idea. So this is monstrous. Now, let's also put it in perspective. All of the so-called felony counts dealing with election law misdemeanors, there's at least one earlier conviction that is acknowledged by Pinckney. Let's look at some other cases, though, some parallel lives. How about Malcolm X? Malcolm X was convicted and imprisoned for 6 years, starting at age 20, for larceny. Martin Luther King was prosecuted for felony tax evasion and perjury by Alabama. Marion Barry, entrapped by a task force. Cornel West, 20 arrests. You know that there's a part of the FBI called Frumenschen, early man or primitive man. They target all black elected officials, I think in some ways black celebrities, lots of them, from O.J. to Cosby, right? Special attention for them. And they go after celebrities, sports figures, God knows what, right? Anybody black and prominent is targeted by the Frumenschen of the FBI. And this goes back to J. Edgar Hoover. What are we kidding? So this requires a different metric. It doesn't mean that you whitewash the shenanigans of Al Sharpton, but this is now a completely different case. And remember, the correct term is not voter fraud. It's vote fraud. Vote fraud done from the top down by the likes of Karl Rove and that system that they had set up in the past election, which was supposed to promote Mitt Romney in there. So we demand the freedom. We demand that somebody come in and get Pinckney out of jail. I call on Obama. Obama just did a bunch of executive clemencies, right? Pardons. And those were for drug dealers. Forget about the drug dealers. Let's get somebody who's actually fighting for a worthwhile cause. So we'll have more about this now in the second hour. But it is the Christmas season, so in our remaining two segments of the first hour, we're going to talk about what you should be doing to promote the cause of peace on earth in the coming weeks. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, in terms of our domestic polity here and what people should be doing, obviously, charity towards prisoners looms very large, right? The seven acts of corporal charity, this is one of them. So the way you can do that is make a contribution to the Pinckney Defense Fund. We'll be giving you the coordinates of that here in just a minute in the beginning of our second hour. And send him a Christmas card, right? Send him some kind of a greeting, right? Maybe there are other things. I don't know what those rules are, but you can, we'll be finding them out as time goes on. So therefore, we want to switch gears now. The essential event of 24-25 December goes like this, right? And this is the famous Luke chapter 2 verse 14, right? There were these shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flocks. And what did they hear? According to the King James Bible, the best we have in the English language, it's glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men. Peace. Then the Catholic one, the Douay Rheims Confraternity Bible, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of goodwill. And we also have a very interesting one, the Aramaic Bible, right? In plain English, glory to God in heaven, and upon earth peace, good news to the children of men. Maybe one more. International Standard Version, sort of mainline Protestant. Glory to God in the highest and peace on earth to people who enjoy his favor. King James 2000. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men. You get the idea. Peace, the Prince of Peace. So do something for peace. And here's my proposal. A campaign on the social media targeting General Allen. And targeting Allen as the centerpiece of a obvious network inside the federal bureaucracy that are constantly pushing Obama towards war. Obama, God knows, is bad enough. He's got his problems. We know them. But the power of the institutions has blunted many of Obama's worst thrusts, and actually made him appear increasingly over the past year as a lesser evil, less of a warmonger than those who are attacking him. Of course, on economics, he's still a Wall Street puppet, as we saw this past week, right? He allowed that provision on the FDIC bailouts of derivatives banks. He didn't want to make a fight about that. All right, there are various reasons for that. But still, the people that are attacking Obama are, in general, much worse than Obama himself. So here's the idea. A social media campaign, and it can be something like this. Hashtag, fire Allen for Xmas. Now, the X is the H in Greek, right? Christos, XR, right? You get the idea? But something like that. Hashtag, fire Allen for Christmas, fire Allen, let number four, XMAS, something like this. Peace on earth, fire Allen. That's another one. Hashtag, peace on earth, fire Allen. The people who are pushing Obama towards war this week, first of all, Allen. We know that Allen, the ISIS czar, fire ISIS czar Allen. That's another one. The ISIS czar Allen is constantly intriguing with Erdogan of Turkey, with the royals of Qatar, and with others, maybe Bandar, I think, different factions of the Saudis, right, in that huge royal family. Allen wants what? He wants to bomb Assad, and he wants to stop attacking ISIS. He wants to preserve ISIS and Nusra and the rest of them. They can be used against Assad today, against Iran tomorrow, and they can be shipped into Chechnya in the coming weeks and months, and they can then wage war against Russia. This guy, Allen, has to go. There are now 2-hour-long interviews with Allen on C-SPAN, one from October, one from early December. Take a look at those. This is a dangerous warmonger operative. And the way it works, of course, is Allen and McGurk are in the State Department. They increasingly dominate what the State Department does vis-a-vis the Middle East. And outside, you've got Petraeus, Kravis, and what is called the Special Operations Community. The Special Operations Community. And we've just seen a terrible example of what they have behind them. Yesterday evening in New York City on Lower Sixth Avenue, we had Jeremy Scahill, that's shill with an A stuck in as camouflage, but Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald. And they're, of course, their stock in trade is that they don't like those evil Middle East dictators like Assad. They want to support the democratic heroes of the anti-Assad resistance. They cover up for the CIA. They cover up for the Joint Special Operations Command. They live in a dream world, but this is what the foundations are willing to fund. And we were able to point out with the help of some pie charts from Cryptome that of the documents given or supposedly purloined by Snowden, a tiny part, maybe 5% or maybe a quarter of a percent or something like this, has ever been distributed. So they've been hoarded. They're probably more secret in the hands of these people because you can't get them through an FOIA. So actually, whatever these things are, if they took the originals, you'll never see them again. So Allen, we got to figure that Allen is pressing and scheming behind the scenes every minute of every day. He has no purpose except the one assigned to him by Petraeus. Start the bombing of Assad. And Obama has said no in public, the famous Brisbane no in November. Do you have a program to overthrow Assad, especially for him? No. And at that point, they've all gone berserk, and they've been berserk. They control the editorial page and the news pages of the Washington Post. So there's one. Now, in the State Department, we have this unfortunate lady, Madame Psaki, P-S-A-K-I. You know her, the redhead. And this past week, Madame Psaki wanted to pull a fast one. She was asked during the State Department briefing, has Obama signed the bill put on his desk by the Congress calling for a new round of sanctions against Russia over Ukraine? And she said, yes, he signed it. This was Tuesday, I believe. And it turned out she was 24 to 36 hours ahead of the curve. It hadn't happened. But she was out there saying it's already done. Now, I think my information now is that Obama did cave, did sign. Obama has just had his press conference here on the Friday afternoon and is on his way out of town. But you get it. He was pushed into this corner, I would say, by somebody like Psaki. Now, he could have used a pocket veto, right? In other words, if Congress leaves town, they're no longer in session, then you simply, you don't sign it. And of course, the Supreme Court, the rats cabal now would argue there's no such thing as a congressional recess. There's no pocket veto because they're always in session. No. All right. And now the other one, when the FBI tells you that the DPRK, North Korea, is responsible for the attacks on Sony. We want to know, where's the proof? Where's the proof? We weren't born yesterday. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., our Christmas show, our pre-Christmas show. And we're just looking at the significance. Right? It's all about the Middle East. It's all about peace in the Middle East, peace on earth among persons of goodwill. All right. So who's the main threat to that? This Christmas, it's ISIS Czar Allen. We want him out. We've certainly got to make sure that the American people know and the world public opinion know that this monstrous design is constantly, these spiders are weaving this web of deceit. And these are the people who are waiting. They're itching for a false flag that they can then use to lift and shift. No more bombing of ISIS, only bomb Assad. That's the goal. Bomb Damascus. Well, you know, that's sort of where Christianity started, right? St. Paul, who organized it on the road, right? They want to bomb that. So the answer is no, right? You call yourself a Christian, you mobilize. You call yourself a person of goodwill, you mobilize. You call yourself someone of positive impulses. You want to play a positive role in history, you mobilize. Fire ISIS Czar Allen. Fire Allen for Christmas. Fire Allen for Xmas. You get the idea. No to Allen. Oust him. That's the Christmas present the American people and the world and the Middle East actually need. And don't be deterred by these fakers and gatekeepers like the Scahills, the Greenwalds, and the Amy Goodmans. They're in big trouble. But now we have the FBI with their immense credibility. The FBI now tells us that it's confirmed that the North Korean regime hacked into Sony. Well, I'm from Missouri. Show me the proof, FBI. I remember your shenanigans on Wen Ho Lee, the Atlanta Olympic bombing, the FBI crime lab, not so good there, and on and on. And now we've gone from Mueller, from St. Paul's School, to Comey. And of course, Comey is a torturer. Comey is a graduate of the torture memorandum. So we're going to have the Comey agency tell us what's actually going on in the world. I'm sorry. You know, We're not total fools, are we? We want to see some proof. And I would say that to Obama. Don't believe it. Time to back off. Don't go any further. So I would say those are the three, right? We could easily do a campaign against Psaki. I think people out in the world have been doing that, right? The various international media have actually focused on her quite a bit. I hope that left liberals or libertarians will come forward and say they don't believe the FBI. That's not exactly a profiling courage to do that. We also should remember, the U.S. was boasting about Stuxnet and Olympic Games, right? The so-called computer viruses that were allegedly introduced into the Iranian computers controlling the Iranian nuclear centrifuges, we're told by the New York Times. Once you start doing that, the golden rule of international relations, whether it's torture or computer viruses or hacking or whatever it is, so whatever you do to the other side will do to you, and they'll be fully justified because you've done it to them and you've even done it to them first. How a country that boasts of shutting down Iranian nuclear centrifuges with Stuxnet could whine when a bunch of Hollywood degenerates and airheads have their emails read? Well, I don't know. There is also this funny question of the overreaction of the Sony, right? Why call off your movie, right? That's a lot of money. Normally, they wouldn't do that. The idea seems to be that there are other items in those emails which are so compromising to these Hollywood hypocrites who run the studio. And we're talking about this charming lady, right? Madame Pascal, I think her name is. You got to wonder where that movie came from. Hollywoodism, right? Hollywoodism. We've had some interesting things about it. I've written an essay about that not long ago. There's always this idea, Santa Monica and Hollywood, and the branch of the Rand Corporation, which is there, that actually I guess it's the headquarters of the Rand Corporation, and to what degree the scenario movies coming out of Hollywood, right, The Lone Gunman or The China Syndrome, any number, are actually coordinated with events, and including false flag events, happening in the world. But the bottom line is the Iranian regime is much too labile to mess around with. It's not worth it. We don't care about the Hollywood airheads. We don't care about this movie. Hollywood obviously feels that they have the right to spew filth out into the world and they'll never be pushed back. Well, here it is, pushback. It's from an ugly source, I guess you'd have to concede. But what the heck, they're on this earth too. And it's just the way it is, right? There's going to be pushback. So the main thing is back away from this. We don't need World War III for the sake of Sony Pictures and their filthy scenario movies, right? And we don't care what the Hollywood airheads think about all of these subjects. Now, the other question we have to deal with is the economic situation. During the course of this year, since about June, the price of oil has gone down by about one half. West Texas Intermediate, North Sea Brent benchmarks down about a half. The Russian ruble is also down about a half. There has been now in the past week this emergency move by the Russian Central Bank. Between Monday and Tuesday, they added 6.5% to their prevalent interest rate. That got them up to 17%. This is a terrible mistake. The person, I think, behind this, there are a number. The head of the central bank is this woman, Nabiullina. We have attacked her as part of the neoliberal cabal. Remember, the neoliberals in the Kremlin include Nabiullina, the head of the central bank. The leader of the faction is Kudrin, the former finance minister. We've also got Siluanov. I think he's the current finance minister. And Shuvalov, who is another top Kremlin official. We should also look at Anatoly Chubais and the Gaidar Foundation. This is Yegor Gaidar, the late privatizing nomenklatura representative who brought oligarchy and suffering back to the Russian people, the shock therapy man working for the IMF. We don't want to forget German Greff, former official from Clinton. This entire group of neoliberals are sabotaging the obvious thing to do. What does Russia need to do? Exchange controls and capital controls. Exchange controls mean you want to take money in or above all out of the country. Fine, maybe you apply for a license from the Treasury. You can't do it with the click of a key on a computer or your cell phone. You got to go through the finance ministry. Exchange controls. Capital controls. You want to take a large sum of money out of the bank? Good. You get a license. What are you going to do with it? Where's it going to go? And monitor it. And then provide the documentation that you did what you thought. There is no doubt, the country of Malaysia, under the powerful leadership of Mahathir Mohamad, back in 1998, instituted capital controls. And they did better than any other country out there in riding out the Asian contagion of 98 to 99. And Russia can and must and should do the same thing. Ride roughshod over the neoliberals, fire a bunch of neoliberals, and go for the Glazyev solution. And the leading edge of Glazyev is don't waste your foreign exchange on defending the currency. Let your exchange controls do that. Back in a minute. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio, our Christmas week program. And we're hoping, we're in touch right now with the Michigan State Prison in Jackson. We're trying to get there okay to bring you an interview with Reverend Edward Pinckney. So they've been getting calls here from the Genesis Communications Network. And that, I think, it's always healthy for such people to know that they're under scrutiny. But while we're waiting to see if we can bring on Reverend Pinckney, I would suggest that we now get a report from Daniela Walls. She is, of course, the chairperson of the Tax Wall Street Party, and she has been one of the leading forces in the defense of Pinckney, his political defense and also his legal defense. So I think we should probably go to Daniela now and get a report about what's going on all of those fronts, right? Remember, Daniela, people have not heard from us on this program since last Friday, so a whole lot has happened in the meantime.
Okay, so I'll try to be thorough. As for getting through to Pinckney, media was able to get through in the last 24 hours, but I've heard that it's getting tougher, and they've been given the opposite of the green light to let media through. So keep pushing. You have the number to get through to Pinckney, but he told me that he absolutely wants to be on the show and tell everybody what's happening, but instead, I'm going to speak for him today, and if you can get through to him, that's great, but he definitely is going to be on next week. So, and I have ways to work on how we can get that done. So Pinckney was sentenced this Monday, December 15th, to 2.5 to 10 years. He was immediately handcuffed on Monday morning and taken out of court and is currently sitting in the Jackson State Prison, 2 hours away from his wife, Dorothy, and legal counsel. He was supposed to be in the local jail, Webster, near the court for at least a period where he had easy access to counsel and family until the judge and the prosecution had time to review and respond to the motions that we filed in our sentencing brief. Pinckney was not legally allowed to be transported away from counsel until the judge and the prosecutor responded to the mandatory sentencing brief, if that makes sense. You're supposed to write a sentencing brief before you're given the sentence. The judge didn't read the sentencing brief. So he was supposed to respond to the brief before making any sentence. But he simply said in court, the prosecution didn't have time to read your brief. They legally have to read the brief to respond before making any sentence. Outside counsel from other states can't believe what's happening. The brief stated that the juror, one of the things that the brief stated was that the juror, Gail Freeling, was not only friends but a work colleague with both Sharon Tyler on the prosecution and Sheriff Paul Bailey. Gail Freeling was asked explicitly under oath if she knew either Clerk Sharon Tyler or Sheriff Paul Bailey. Those were the two key people. Under oath, Gail Freeling said no. That is not true. We worked with Pinckney to expose the fact that Gail Freeling, the lying juror in this case, lied under oath about her personal connections to these key individuals. This proved that we had a packed jury, and there's other things in the sentencing brief as well. I'm just going to focus on this for now. The motion that the jury was packed was presented as part of Pinckney's sentencing brief that by law they had to respond to. So this motion was filed before the deadline. This is important because the judge agreed to a deadline with us. And he said, we all know that I have to respond to your sentencing brief before sentencing you. That means the prosecution, this Mike Sepik, would have to come up with an argument in court why the sentencing brief we presented was meaningless if that was their decision. He would have to make a list of arguments. So this motion was filed before the deadline. So the judge, the prosecutor, and our legal team agreed on a date. We filed well before the deadline. So the judge agreed to it. So his argument in court, in quotes, was the prosecution didn't have time to read or respond to it. That is illegal. We agreed to a deadline. We were before it. He says we didn't have time to read it. They have to respond. And in fact, they have to respond. So in fact, right now they are responding, Webster. That's why it's important that we keep up the international media pressure and the national media pressure. This is no time to go soft. They should have had Pinckney in the local jail so he could talk to his lawyer right near the courthouse while they responded to the sentencing brief, and then they could overturn the sentencing, give a new trial, throw it out. There's a myriad of things that can still happen. But instead, what they did was they sent Pinckney 2 hours away to a prison. At first it was a place called quarantine, which is similar to a solitary confinement, but outside counsel called the lawyer and told him that was highly illegal, that he couldn't consult with counsel. So I'm not sure, because you never know what goes on behind closed doors, why they allowed him to start talking to the media and to counsel, but I think that might have been why. We filed the motion before the deadline. The judge, and so right now they're currently responding to it, so do not let keep up the pressure. So the judge and the prosecutor, Mike Sepik, know that they have to respond, and they are responding. And this could mean that they can throw out the sentence, like I said, or give a retrial. So that's all illegal that they shipped him to Jackson State Prison. Pinckney is 66 years old, and a 2.5 to 10 year sentence is a lot of time. This was the reason for this large range of time is to send a message. And this is all about sending a message. All of this from the beginning has been about sending a message to the community to be afraid and to Pinckney to be afraid. And the message is that we'll give you 2.5 years at 66 years old if you shut your mouth and you don't protest from prison. And if you don't shut your mouth and keep protesting, it's going to be 10. And Reverend Pinckney begged me, said, I want you to tell the world, Daniela. He calls me Danielle. He doesn't do the A, but he goes, Danielle, you tell the world, do not give in to their fear tactics. Do not stop anything. We are fighting a larger war to tax Whirlpool, which pays no taxes to the city or federal income tax while the community suffers in Benton Harbor. The larger war he speaks about is to restore democracy and racial justice to Michigan cities and free trade, bring back American manufacturing jobs, etc. So he said, do not give in to their fear tactics. Benton Harbor is in worse shape, but Benton Harbor is a microcosm, make no mistake about it, of America and what America is going to look like if we don't fight back now. This is the fight. It's a vision of things to come. Benton Harbor is Pottersville from It's a Wonderful Life. It's every one of those metaphors. Reverend Pinckney is fighting for democracy in a company town. I'd like to thank some of the activists because there's a lot that they did to reduce what could have possibly happened. And don't think you didn't help. They're trying to create propaganda as if the activists are crazy liberals or don't know what's going on. They're trying to paint a picture. We had over 100 letters flood into the judge from around the country and 10 different nations. He says over 100. We don't know the number. That could be 167. That could be 190. We don't know what he means by that. But Judge Schirach made a big deal of these letters in local press coverage and in the news. Every news show he's on, mainstream news, he says, I got over 100 letters but he has to find a way to put him down, right, Webster? So he says they came from outside of Benton Harbor. So this is just a tactic to say that nobody in the community is on Reverend Pinckney's side. But the truth is that everybody in Southwest Michigan in Benton Harbor is afraid. They have been victims for decades of institutional racism, poverty, harassment by the Whirlpool Corporation's henchmen like Judge Chirac, and Pinckney is the last person that's standing up. So that's what's going on. And he had a bunch, he had 50 or more people outside the courtroom, and Dorothy reported to me that the court room was packed, and outside the courtroom on the street, or the courthouse, I'm sorry, on the street, there were over 50. So I don't have a total count on that. But here's what's going on. Pinckney has enemies in high places. Do not underestimate how high this goes. The corruption goes up to the highest levels of government and corporate collusion. We've had a hit piece written by the Heritage Foundation the other day, Webster. The Heritage Foundation itself wrote a hit piece saying Pinckney is guilty of election fraud. And it says these crazy liberal activists are coming to his defense. Pinckney was no crazy liberal, Democrat, Republican fighting for justice. This article was clearly written by somebody, which interested me.
Well, we know, Danielle, I went through, Hans von Spakovsky is a well-known hack. He's been on C-SPAN. He's all over the place. Thank you very much. I think we've covered the waterfront. So we'll see you again next week, huh? And we'll try to get some good news for the Welcome Back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So there you have it. This is the situation. So, again, get any honest journalist, get the facts. You can go to the Free Pinckney WordPress site. You can go to my site. You can find this. Look up Pinckney. You'll get to us quite easily. I should have mentioned, right, von Spakovsky, the von, right, the V-O-N. The V-O-N means he's a nobleman. That was what I was trying to get at, right, the East Elbian Junker possibility. There was some other equally dubious from a democratic point of view background. So that's the guy from the Heritage Foundation, right, a very well-known person. He is the co-author with John Fund, another well-known hack. You've seen him around, too. Obama's enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department by Hans von Spakovsky and John Fund. So you get the idea, right, that they're bringing out their big guns. And notice the contradiction. The judge says there was no support for Pinckney in the town. And von Spakovsky freaks out saying, why, they were all there supporting Reverend Pinckney, and don't tell me they all came from outside, right? The old outside agitator line, right? So we had Bull Connor, move over Bull Connor. We've had Joe Arpaio, Maricopa, move over Joe. We've got Sheriff Paul Bailey. Now let's continue on our economic point now. Russia is making a mistake to the extent that they don't institute capital controls and exchange controls. This would be, first and foremost, a service that Russia can do for itself. Obviously, though, the deeper issue is the Putin formula for governing the country is essentially the statists, the ones that I support, the people who are part of the old Soviet government, Soviet security services, Red Army, and the party, right? A lot of them are interested in dirigistic solutions, right? That would be Glazyev. Glazyev is a dirigist. He's not a communist. He represents what you could call the German or American school, Friedrich List, people of this type, Henry Carey, Alexander Hamilton, sure. So that's one group. But then there's this other group. There's the group that was created by the shock therapy. In other words, out of the defeat and the breakup of the Soviet Union came another group, the oligarchs, the shock therapy practitioners, right? That would be Yegor Gaidar, Anatoly Chubais. You can read about this in the book that I contributed to, right? Market Bolshevism, The Tragedy of Russia's Reforms. And what they did was nomenklatura privatization. Now, as long as it was Khodorkovsky, he was attempting to come into the political realm, right? Because Khodorkovsky says, I own all the oil in the country. I'm the richest man in Russia. If I see Berlusconi as head of Italy, I, Khodorkovsky, should be the head of Russia. Well, no, you go to Siberia for 10 or 12 years. Good. But they're still there. And Chubais, you should remember, Chubais was the one who carried out the nomenklatura privatizations. In other words, the massive theft of the state property of the Soviet Union, right? Huge raw materials deposits, considerable heavy industry, all kinds of valuable, important assets. Chubais superintended, shepherded the process by which these were essentially stolen from the Soviet people and given to this new nomenklatura oligarchy of theft, right, and usury and what have you. So those guys are still there, and they want to see the neoliberal rules maintained. So what I think what's going on in Moscow, from afar, venturing a surmise here, that it's the statists against the ripoff artists. In other words, it's the people who are concerned about the long-term health and well-being of the Russian people and the Russian economy against this other group who say there are universal laws. This is Medvedev. I guess Medvedev is in some ways the leader of this, maybe not the leader, but the figurehead of the group. Where Medvedev said in a recent session at the Kremlin, there are objective laws of economic development which we cannot change. That's ridiculous. That's, what can we call this? The British poison. Angliski Yad is the poison of free market, free trade doctrine, which never developed anybody. Whereas the German school made Germany into the greatest industrial power of Europe, American school, U.S. greatest industrial power in the world until last month, and so on down the line. In other words, that's the development economics that actually work. The Glazyev approach, as we've said, is, first of all, exchange controls, capital controls. Actually, Glazyev even goes further. He's got an idea saying, if you want to export capital out of Russia, not only you're going to have to get a permit, you're going to have to pay a tax. That's great. Tax capital flight. Flight capital, right? The idea that, you know, the U.S. and the British have been boasting, London economists boasting, oh, look at all this wonderful flight capital. The Russians are going to be left holding nothing, but their eyes to cry with. Well, you put an end to that by capital controls and exchange controls. And I'm not just making this up. Go to my Twitter feed there, Webster G. Tarpley, and you will see I have linked there to all kinds of articles that talk about generally the British. It's precisely somebody well connected to the services, like Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the London Daily Telegraph, an old enemy. He talks openly, saying, oh, there's a danger. Oh, the worst thing they could do would be to have these terrible, everybody's afraid of capital controls and exchange controls. No, that's exactly what you want to have. And remember, right now the ruble, as of about the last several weeks, has been floating. So dirty float, it's floating, but every now and then you come in and you try to do a bear squeeze, right? You try to punish the people that are short the ruble by driving it up a little bit, okay? Try to bankrupt some of them. That is the overall reality, but the idea is you're still going to be using up reserves, right? If they have 400 to 450 billion of dollar and euro and hard currency reserves, that can go out the window in a week if you try to defend a valuation for the ruble. So don't do it. Go to the Glazyev plan. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Before we go any further, let me tell you concerning the class, the cadre school, the symposium, the econothon, the acceleration program, what can we say, total immersion, weekend short course, the political economy of the American system. We are closing in on venues. We've identified a number of choices. It's probably going to be that time there, the 23rd, 24th, 25th of January. I hope by the next program to give you the specifics, but don't wait for that. Follow the Webster G. Tarpley Twitter feed, and I'll have it up there. As soon as we ink the deal, we'll tell you, but it's coming. You want to do something in the meantime to get ready? Go and buy Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide through the greatest financial crisis in human history, with the second edition, I recommend. Second edition, which includes significant commentary on the 2008-2009 crisis, which the book predicted. What did it predict? That we were the oncoming cataclysm. The oncoming cataclysm, that was written in 1999, just at the time that Glass-Steagall had been lifted, and above all, the liberalization and deregulation of derivatives was coming in the following year. So, Surviving the Cataclysm, try that for your holiday reading. It's about 650 pages. I urge you to buy it and read it, and especially if you want to come to this class, why, it's required reading, so you get the idea. Now, having offered our advice to Russia and Putin, right, this, again, this is the weak side of Putin, is this. Why did he have people like Gref and Kudrin in power until only a couple of years ago? And with Kudrin, he's apparently trying to come back in through the back door. Anatoly Chubais is on one of the advisory boards of J.P. Morgan Chase. Anatoly Chubais is a member of the New York Council on Foreign Relations. It is a foreign faction. The neoliberals in Russia are a foreign body projected in there by the U.S., the Federal Reserve, the British, the Bank of England, the International Monetary Fund, and so on down the line. Larry Summers was a big guy in the course of this, right? It was in the name of these neoliberals that the parliament was shot to hell in 1992 when it was being occupied, remember, by Khasbulatov and those people, right? The Red-Brown group. Well, Red-Brown, I think, is overdone. But you see, there was the goal was to make Russia safe for the IMF shock therapy. And the Russian people have been taken to the cleaners twice in 91-92, a hyperinflation of 1,500%, and then again in 1998, the state bankruptcy, the GKO default on Russian state debt in 1998, which was the peak of the Asian contagion. And now, apropos of that, if we go back to 1998, we have all of these clowns who are gloating. They're going to break the back of the Russian economy, say these Anglo-American parrots, consultants in the press. One of them, in a moment of lucidity, asked, I think, a very important question. Before you go ahead and try to break the back of the Russian economy, dear friends, says this guy, and it's in the Washington Post somewhere, he says, don't you want to think about what that will mean for the world? Now, concerning the breaking of the back, may be ultra vires. In other words, it's not clear whether the Anglo-Americans can break the back of the Russian economy. I would incline to say they probably can't break the back, but they can do tremendous damage. The Anglo-American financial power remains enormous. And remember, compared to 1998, you've now got credit default swaps that can be used to attack a currency. And we've seen in the case of the drachma, the peseta, the lira, you know, the various state bonds of those countries that used to be in those denominations. In other words, the Greeks, the Spanish, the Italians, and so forth. That's all credit default swaps that you have today that you really didn't have, at least in that form, in 1998-1999. So, if we look back, though, to 1998, what do we see? when the Russian economy got into severe difficulty, and again, bank deposits were wiped out, there was some quite a bit of hyperinflation going around, what was the effect here in the West? Well, there was something called long-term capital management of Connecticut. Long-term capital management, and what happened to them? They blew, and they had various Federal Reserve people on their board. This was a real dirty speculative derivatives operation at the time, and this blew a hole of what, $10, $20 billion of those days, 1998, into the world economy. And they were immediately given a backdoor bailout by Alan Greenspan. And man, you can read all about this in Surviving the Cataclysm, the second edition in particular. So all of that, that's what's, what the thing that set the stage for the 2008 bailout was, the backdoor bailout by Greenspan, 10 years earlier, just about exactly. So my question now is, if in 1998, the spin-off, the byproduct of the attack on Russia, was long-term capital management, who is it this time? Who is the long-term capital management of this round of economic warfare against Russia, right? So, and remember, this is boomerang time, right? It's like you let off poison gas in front of your own trenches and the wind blows it back on you. The wind changes. That can easily happen. So, which one of the zombie banks or the hedge fund hyenas? I would say quite a few hedge fund hyenas. We have word of one of the subsets of PIMCO, which had invested in Russian bonds. They're obviously in big trouble. Will that peg down at PIMCO as a whole? And PIMCO is troubled because we had Bill Gross leaving, driven out of PIMCO. So PIMCO may be in trouble. Who knows? And that's just the biggest bond fund. All the little people have bought bonds with PIMCO, thinking that that's valuable. Well, they've got one fund that seems to have made the wrong bet. Whether that turns into long-term capital management, I do not know. Time will tell, but always a defensive position for the individual, the little person in these situations is in order. But then it's more complicated, right? It's not just Russia that's hit by a lower oil price. And we have to say, who is the evil demiurge behind this whole thing? It's Prince Bandar. This is Bandar. Remember, Bandar had gone to Putin about a year ago and said, Putin, you stop supporting Assad or we will terrorize you with terrorism. And Putin, I guess, threw him out or told him to, told him the interview was over. Bandar. I call Bandar the new Herod of this holiday season. The new Herod, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, right? The dominant figure of the royal family and the intelligence, operation. If anybody says pump oil like mad to hit Russia, to hit Iran, and to hit others, even these shale characters in the U.S., who we don't really need. That's Bandar. So, the new Herod. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. The last segment of our Christmas week, program. Best wishes to everybody. Best wishes for Hanukkah and all other, festivities. Kwanzaa, if that's, your holiday. And, any others that I've, forgotten, right? Because the idea is peace and goodwill towards people. And in line with that, remember, the slogan for this holiday season is Peace on Earth, Fire Allen. Peace on Earth, Fire ISIS Czar Allen. Merry Christmas. Fire Allen for Christmas. You get the idea. With those hashtags, those sharps out in front, right? The diesis out in front. So we're looking at who's going to be the next long-term capital management. I just, one other thing I've got to remember. We are going to have this course. It's going to be in the Washington area. It's looking more and more possible to do something around the 23rd, 24th, 25th of January. That is, between MLK and the Super Bowl. Super Bowl being February 1st. But we're going to be here, not stupefied, but with a total immersion weekend short course, right? It'd be the equivalent of an actual 10 or 12 week academic course in many ways. So the rest of the holiday season, who's going to be the next long-term capital management? Right? That can be masked, I guess, during Christmas, but by the first couple of weeks of January, you're going to see who's going to blow. Who is LTCM this time? Read about it in Surviving the Cataclysm. But there are others now. Venezuela. Venezuela could blow. If Venezuela blows, which New York zombie banks will blow? Right? Used to be Citibank was the leader in Latin loans. Argentina. The feds, this character, Judge Griesa, has been attempting to drive Argentina into default. Maybe he'll succeed, and maybe it'll be Argentina and Venezuela. Will that blow enough of a hole? So this entire thing is very, very shaky. And, of course, the other thing that Putin might well consider is look at the BRICS and look at the BRICS Bank. The BRICS Bank can do all sorts of things. The BRICS Bank can also be of assistance vis-a-vis Russia, not for the purpose of throwing money down the rat hole of trying to support the ruble. Put those controls on and then use that money for joint ventures with China, with India, and so forth. And build up that BRICS bank, because that's the real defense. Now we got to talk quickly about a number of things. Take a look at the Washington Post this week. Interesting article. It's called A Black Hole for Our Best and the Brightest. Wall Street is expanding and the economy is worse off for it. And the idea is that the financial part has undergone hypertrophy. It's too big. The financial industry has doubled in size as a share of the economy in the past 50 years, but it hasn't gotten any better at growth, profit, and jobs. In 2012, economists at the International Monetary Fund analyzed data across years and countries and concluded that in some countries, including the U.S., the financial sector had grown so large that it was slowing economic growth using a different methodology. The most prominent researcher on the size and economic value of Wall Street, a New York University economist named Thomas Philippon, estimates that the United States is sinking nearly $300 billion per year too much into finance. The $300 billion is approximately one estimate that we have of the take on the Wall Street sales tax. Slap on a 1% Wall Street sales tax, you'll cut the financial sector down to sustainable proportions. Perhaps the starkest illustration here and still in the Washington Post. Economists from Harvard University and the University of Chicago wrote in a recent paper that every dollar a worker earns in a research field makes the economy $5 better off. That's like NASA. Every dollar a similar worker earns in finance is a drain, making the economy 60 cents worse off. Well, that's because scientific research is production and financial speculation is not production. It's a net drain. You got it. There's such a thing as production and not. Now we want to congratulate Obama on normalizing with Greece. We'll probably spend some time profiling the Miami Cuban machine, right? These oligarchs, the Ross Leightons, the Diaz Balarts, but then also the Orlando Bosch and the Luis Posada Carriles gang, when we look at the CIA Cubans from the Bay of Pigs to JFK to Watergate, Iran-Contra, and I think 9/11 in South Florida where those pilots were supposedly training. That looks JM Wave, CIA Miami Station, the CIA mission to those reactionary Cubans. Bad for the U.S. So we welcome the normalization of relations. Now, one hopeful sign, a kind of an epiphany that can be coming early in the new year. The president Sea of Greece is on the line. Now, there's been one attempt this past week to elect the president of Greece. This is done in the parliament, right, by electors, right? It's not a mass vote. They tried to get the right-wing candidate, the reactionary, the Samaras candidate, into the presidency of Greece. It's failed. There's going to be another vote on Christmas Eve on the 23rd of December, and I hope we'll be able to bring it to you next week. We're going to have another vote to try to elect the president of Greece. If that fails, there's going to be a general election sometime in January, February, and I hope it will be an epiphany. I hope it's going to be the victory of Syriza, of Alexis Tsipras, and his anti-IMF, anti-Troika, anti-Memorandum of Understanding, anti-conditionalities, no to the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the IMF, no Troika. That's going to be Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras of Greece. And that's going to mean a huge debate worldwide on economics. So start reading economics. Start reading Surviving the Cataclysm. I think it's all in all still by far the best, better than Piketty. Talks about production and non-production, which Piketty can't seem to understand. Philippon can't seem to understand that either. The traditional classical economics just doesn't have that, right? Production. What is that? Productivity. No, doesn't exist. Greece may awaken the world into some kind of a Southern European springtime. By the way, the Grillo movement is collapsing. This demagogic movement, which is anti-infrastructure, collapsing under the weight of the monstrous personality of Grillo. But any pseudo-leftist or left-liberal mushhead who thought that Grillo had the answer, he expelled two or three of his senators, and now he's got an expulsion list of about 20, and the whole thing is gonna break up. And Grillo is moving more and more to the right as an anti-immigrant racist. Those are his true colors, right? He's a Pujadist, he's a Qualunquista, he's a petty bourgeois racist and reactionary radical. So all of that is going. Finally, the proposition of Christmas, right? God is willing to come into the world. God is willing to become flesh, just like us. It means that the material universe, and for that matter the human body, is not necessarily evil. It could be evil, but it could be good. It's up to you. Free will. So, it is a refutation of the dualistic religions, and indeed of the Nirvana religions, that God can come into the world. Remember, at Easter time, we have Judas, who's promoted by the Rockefeller Foundation, but Judas was trying to help Christ. That's a terrible mistake. Well, no. We here have to say, one of the people trying to make optimism, is that God is willing to come into the world. The universe is not evil. It can't be good, so go and make it good. Back next week.